Petition number 209.84, Rule 3.
Captain Phillips, Reel 3.
So, whenever Rommel made a hole in the line, which he was doing rather frequently because it was his last big thrust to stay, really, in Tunisia, and wherever he made a very nasty hole, which he did, we were sent up as plumbers, really, to stop the leak. It was a long line. It started from Bizerta right up in the north of Tunisia, right down to well below Kasserine, the Kasserine Pass. The 8th Army was not all that far away. They were having their battles on the Maris line coming up from the desert. And so we eventually get down to Kasserine. Now, that was a very narrow thing because Rommel's Tiger tank boys were brilliant. There's no doubt about that. But they were well matched by our 26th Armored Brigade, which was the Lothian and Border Horse, the 16th 5th Lancers, and the 17th 21st Lancers, which was, I think, one of the most exciting and stylish brigades in the armoured world at that time. And the American boys hadn't had a great deal of training. So they roared up full of go and guts in their Sherman tanks, and it was disastrous. Rommel gave them a real right bashing. And it looked as if Rommel would get through and come right down the Kasserine. There were some tremendous infantry battles. The 3rd Battalion Welsh Guards, who had come out to reinforce the 1st Guards Brigade in which we were in, and very good they were too, they were up on the hills just to the side of the pass. And they fought a great infantry battle and had a great many casualties, but they kept the German infantry at bay. And we then dug in the Kasserine Pass. It was marvellous to be able to dig. It was sort of very sandy soil, naked in out of the desert. And so we dug deep, deep down, like 6 foot. So that if the Tiger tanks attacked us, which they did the next day, we would just sort of squat down and they would go over our heads without damaging us. But unfortunately, the American armored boys had a terrible defeat. And they came back and it looked as if Rommel was through. But really by amazing heroism from quite small British units, and I have to say one or two very good American units, they didn't get very far. We went up to, I can't remember the name of the town, but a place not very far from Kasserine, and for a 2-day rest out of the line. And at that time, a message came through that the next course at Soucarras on mine warfare was about to start, and this chap Phillips better be sent up sharpish. So I was put in a truck and driven up. And there, the road was blocked. I thought I'd again be late, and I didn't want to miss out on the course. And so I sort of became a policeman directing traffic. I'd never seen so many troops of different nationalities all banging into each other. It was chaos. And then a man, a very calm man, in a jeep, driving a jeep, came up and stopped just opposite me and my driver. And he said, do you want to get through? And I said, yes, I do, sir. I said, sir, sharply, because I suddenly realized it was General Alexander coming up to see what was going on. And he was his usual charming, calm self, nice smile. He saw on my shoulder Coast Stream Guards, and he said, well, He said, "I believe your battalion did well, and I'm going up to congratulate the Welsh Guards. They did very well indeed." And he said, "Right." And very quietly, he gave commands to various motorbike chaps and one or two red caps, who he gave a rocket to. And they cleared a way for us to get through the melee and arrive at Souk Arras. As a dyslexic, it was difficult because there were quite a few calculations in mine warfare which had to be made. But I actually quite enjoyed the course. And funny enough, I reckon to myself, and dyslexics do have rather big inferiority complexes, academic-wise, I realized that it's probably the best course I'd ever been on, and to my amazement, passed out high. Went back and became, to the battalion, the pioneer platoon commander, who did all the mine warfare for the battalion, laid all the mines, set the booby traps, undid the German booby traps, and so on. And it was a very fascinating time in the battalion. The pioneer platoon commander was usually referred to in my battalion as foul ground, because one of the duties were that when the battalion left a position, they had to fill in all the places where the officers and men did their morning duties. And it wasn't a very pleasant job, but that was one of the jobs for the pioneer platoon. And apparently, and it very nearly happened, they also had the job of executing. So that if, for instance, somebody did a terrible thing, German, or presumably English, it never happened, that the pioneer platoon was the firing squad. So I make that. But it very nearly did happen when a sniper shot the commanding officer's soldier servant in Hammond Leaf. And the fury, because the war was finished more or less, very nearly, there was such fury that there was, it was contemplated that I might have to have him, this sniper, executed. He was a real Nazi and he was shouting and screaming, Heil Hitler and all that. And apparently Colonel Roddy Hill, just for a moment, contemplated that the best place for him was either in heaven or hell. But thank God we didn't actually have to do it. And so the battle went on. It was thrilling, really. One shouldn't enjoy warfare. I think one can be excited by it. And, of course, you had this terrific rivalry between very strong horsemen, fox hunting men, I suppose, between the 11th Hussars and the Derbyshire Yeomanry. And they were both determined to get into Tunis first. And we could hear through our wireless sets all these sort of war cries going on from both lots. And one knew a lot of them. They were one's friends. And it's still debated who actually did get in first. The Derbyshire Yeomanry claim that they did. And they came in from slightly different side to the 11th. But some of my friends in both those regiments claimed to be winners. We then had our final battle on the hills to three peaks above Hammond Leaf, where the Bey of Tunis's palace was situated. That was one of the craziest battles I ever took part in. The Welsh Guards, the 3rd Battalion Welsh Guards, went in daylight, which I think was a grave error of judgment on behalf of the general concerned. And they mowed down, because the Germans not only had 88 millimetres quite high in the hills, but they also had extremely accurate mortar and machine gun fires, and they suffered quite a few casualties, including really my best friend at school, Hugh Arbuthnot in the Welsh, and he was quite severely wounded. We took the three peaks and then moved towards the town of Hammond Leaf, And we were held up by four, I think, there may have been only three, German 88mm guns, very well positioned. And so our armour couldn't get through. And so, a typical sort of cavalry officers, they said, OK, well, we'll go along the water. And so, in these Shermans, they literally splashed along the beach, which Hammond Leaf was on. And the Lothian and Border Horse went, I think, in the lead, and they destroyed the 88 millimeters. It was the most extraordinary sight, looking down from our positions in the hills. We were fighting the remnants of their infantry, seeing the tanks literally almost in the sea, going along the beach, and a very, very brave effort. They were a marvellous brigade, and all three regiments, the Lothians, 17th, 21st, and the 16th, 15th, were absolutely incredibly good. So then I thought, well, that's that. It looks as if the war's damn nearly over, because the 8th Army now was coming up the other end of Cap Bon. And so we were getting very, very excited about the possibility of peace. I was then sent for by my commanding officer, and it said, now, we don't know whether the Pioneer Platoon has, in its terms of reference, the duty of taking bays or kings in their palaces, or even going to close down harems. But mark, you're going into the palace with your men, you're going to seize the Bey of Tunis and his guards, and you'll see if in fact the girls are still alive in the harem. Excuse me. So I thought, well, this is a bit of a lark, and so did my chaps. So we attacked, we were fired at by the Bey's band, who were in the most marvellous, colourful uniforms. It's been written up, this in quite a few histories, in the Coldstream Regimental history, No Dishonourable Name, and one or two other books. And so we bashed our way in the front door, and they fired at us from the top of the stairs. They did put up fairly good resistance to protect their king, their bey. And we have one casualty, but they weren't very good shots. And if you don't mind, I'm going to cough, if I may.
Yes. My.
So the next thing was to find where the bey was. And there he was in a room upstairs. And he wasn't at all pleased to see us. He had supported the Germans. And so we were a little bit rough with him. But in true sort of good man of British way, we didn't handcuff him or anything like that. But we pushed him rather heavily down the stairs and put him in a truck, and he was taken off to our intelligence chaps up the road. And so there we rounded up the Bey's guards and their band and went down to the harem, which is an extraordinary sight. This has also been written up in one or two books. But they were a pathetic lot. They were guarded by these eunuchs, who were, on the whole, very fat, very nasty, smarmy-looking men. And they were bowing to us and, you know, really trying to suck up to us in every way. And so we interviewed a few of the French-speaking girls. And then from the corner of the room came a voice, a very rather London voice from a girl. And she came, believe it or not, from Hackney Wick. And she had been put into the slave trade in about 1939. And she'd been put into the harem, I think, a little later. She'd been in a brothel in Tunis for a time. And she was a very attractive, a very charming girl. And so we really used her as a sort of interpreter of what had been going on. And it was an extraordinary day in the life of a soldier. I went to report to Colonel Roddy Hill and then returned to find my sergeant major sitting on the throne and with one or two guardsmen sort of standing in a sort of Victorian stance, while another chap took a photograph of them. It was a very, very funny sight. And the sergeant major stood up and he said, "Well, we've got them all now, sir." He said, "I think we've done our job." And so he said, "Would you like to have a photograph sitting on the throne?" So I said, "Yes, that would be good." Which I did. And then back we went into the final attack, and then rounding up hundreds of thousands of prisoners who were all waiting, if possible, to be shipped back to Sicily and Italy, and never made it. It was an extraordinary sight. And it was my 21st birthday, and the first time the battalion had all eaten together in under one mess of a big marquee, big tent. That morning, we had taken General von Spanik and the 90th Light Division, who had fought brilliantly, really, throughout the whole of the desert campaign, and had quite often fought units in which Brigade of Guards had been in. And so Colonel Roddy, when he arrived, this distinguished-looking general saluted, and Roddy saluted him, and he said, "We've come round this way, which might surprise you, to surrender." And he said, "We've got no more ammunition, no more food." And so Colonel Roddy said to him, "Well, I thought you'd come round rather the longer route from where we knew you were. Why was that?" And he said, "Because we wanted to surrender to you and not the Americans. We fought the Coldstream and the Grenadiers and the Scots Guards for many years in the desert. We wanted to surrender to you." So Colonel Roddy, as if it was a sort of country house party, said, "Well, it's very good of you. We appreciate that. We've always admired your division. Would you like to have dinner with us tonight? Because it's the first time that we've all had a meal together for a very long time, the officers." He said, "That's very kind of you." And he said, "If you also have my ADC, who is an SS, very unpleasant-looking German major." And so he looked very surly and obviously not enjoying himself at all. But nevertheless, the general and he sat down to dinner. And Colonel Roddy made a very good speech. And then turned to the general and he said, "You'll appreciate, General, that we got to drink a toast to our victory." General Alexander's telegram to Churchill, copies of which had been sent round, was read out. And the general just nodded his head and he said, "I understand." And so then after that, Roddy said, "There's no need for you to stand or drink to it, General. Retain your seat." And then the next toast was to His Majesty the King. And he stood to that, the General. He just held his glass. And I was literally a few feet away from him. And he just held his glass but didn't actually drink. Fair enough. But the SS man hurled his glass on the floor. And the general very quietly said, "I would be most grateful if you put that man under close arrest. He is a bastard." There's absolute silence. There's no sort of clapping or cheering, which there probably would be on some BBC show at the moment. It was absolute silence and great dignity. And then, very quietly, Roddy put his glass up and he said, "Mark, I think this is a good occasion to wish you a happy birthday. What an interesting way to come of age. And the general, who had a stick, which he'd had in, niches put in all the battles he'd fought in, including Moscow, he said, "No use to me now. May this be a present to a young officer." I was very touched. And I think everybody was. And we all got, I think, a little bit inebriated. And that was the end of the war in Tunisia. Extraordinary, really. A lot of human touches. And it's very difficult. We just found it difficult to get used to not digging a trench every night. Not being bombed by a far too accurate Luftwaffe. It was very difficult to get used to suddenly peace in Africa. But we did, and we were all given leave to go into Tunis. And Alexander is a great, great commander. And he said, "Let the lads enjoy themselves." And Monty was inclined to close the odd brothels, and Alexander was inclined to reopen them. It is an extraordinary sort of way of life, but Alexander reckoned the troops needed a little of that there. But we got used to it, the peace, and began preparing for the next move.
Was that Italy?
The next move, in fact, was Pantelleria, the island, which General Doolittle, the American general, reckoned could be won by terrifying bombing. And when we were in the thick of that, we were told to make haste and go over to the island of Lampedusa, which the British intelligence didn't seem to realize was pretty heavily defended by Germans and Italian troops, with quite a few airplanes on it. And so Bill Harris, commanding number one company, he went in and was immediately met by the governor, an Italian admiral, who said, "We're not going to surrender. We've got 2,000 troops there. You've just got one company of infantry soldiers." So Bill Harris, later to become a judge, he said to the drill sergeant, "Slope arms, if you would, drill sergeant, because there's a bit of paper which we're going to put on the butt of your rifle for this admiral to sign. He's got to sign the surrender now." So the Italian admiral wasn't at all keen to sign the surrender. But Sergeant Major, Drill Sergeant Knight, one of the smartest drill sergeants in the battalion, sloped arms, and Bill Harris put the bit of paper on the butt of the rifle. He said, "Now, admiral." And he refused. They said, "Well, I have a signal, a secret signal, which will go to the destroyer just outside the island, and the destroyer will signal only 200 flying fortresses, which will destroy this island of Lampedusa entirely. And you too." And he said, "Yes, probably us too. But we'll shoot a few of you before we go, then we shall probably get back to our landing craft. So we reckon it might be a good thing, admiral, for you to sign now." So he discussed it with one or two other people, and Bill put the surrender bit of paper on Drill Sergeant Knight's butt. The admiral signed it, and the island was ours. The Germans weren't terribly pleased about it. It was a bit eerie, because there we were, a very small little unit, with 2,500 very well-armed troops, German and Italian.
You personally were present?
I was present with number one company. The rest of the battalion then came in haste. They arrived just a little later. And we were given jobs to do. I was given the embarkation on what they call Phillips Beach. And we embarked the armor and transport and equipment and food came in from Sousse on the Tunisian coast and from Tripoli, and they went back with the German and Italian prisoners. Eventually we were left alone, we got all our prisoners back. They went back to, eventually, Tunisia. And we stayed there for about, 3 weeks. A plaque was put up in the square called Coaststream Square. It stayed there quite a long time. And the Germans actually bombed the Italians and us about a fortnight later. They didn't have much respect for their allies, I don't think. And then I was left behind when the battalion went back to Tunisia with the transport, because the boat wasn't big enough to take the transport. So I waited with the governor, who in fact was a wing commander in the Royal Air Force, a very nice man, who I'm sorry to say his name I forget for the moment, whose obituary was in the Telegraph about 3 weeks ago. He was a splendid person, and he and I messed together, and he became the governor, and he said, now you can either take the transport over to Tripoli with the next boat that comes, or wait an even longer time to get back to Sousse. So I said, fine, we'll go to Tripoli. And so all the battalion transport and I went back with the drivers. And we had a day out in Tripoli. And they motored all the way through the old battlegrounds of the 8th Army back again to Tunis, where we assisted all the troops going through the port for the Sicilian landing. And then they went on to Italy. And that was more or less the end of my war. I've left out that when we were encamped at Constantine, we were attacked by some Arabs who were already at that time stealing arms and other things in preparation for the war years later against the Jews. Extraordinary that they were thinking about it even in those days. And our camp was raided.
What did that amount to?
Well, not a big raid. There were just a few Arabs used to come in under the cloak of darkness. And I was in a tent sharing it with a very good rugby player. I believe he actually played for England once, called Ray Crouch, a very brave man, and Alan Pemberton. We were all subalterns. We were sharing this tent, and Alan Pemberton, incidentally, later commanded the regiment in peacetime at Barricade Walk, a very, very fine soldier, with a very, very good MC. Very nice chap. And so I pulled the revolver from under my pillow, and we didn't ask questions when those chaps arrived. And this chap was snooping around trying to find this Arab, trying to find where our arms were and anything else. And so very quietly under my mosquito net, I aimed my revolver at him, and I fired five shots, and the only noise was click, click, click. It wasn't loaded. So that wasn't very clever of me. And actually, to my relief, the Arab then jumped out and joined his friends and ran up the hill through the forest with about six of us after him. And I was perhaps stupid enough to get to the top first, where they had open ground to go across afterwards, so they hurled a rock at me and that knocked me out. And so the others, they got one of them, I think, and they went back to their villages some miles away. And really, that was the end of everything, because I really was quite seriously hurt. And so it was decided that, well, with my war wounds, which weren't actually healing very well, that I ought really to go back on the hospital ship to England. And